Our first reading is from an ancient source, Mark 16. Very early, on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will find him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
And our second reading today from a modern source is from an article entitled "Resurrecting Easter" by John Dominic Crossan and Sarah Sexton Crossan. They write, "In the Bible, there is no direct account of the resurrection. There are stories about the empty tomb and Christ appearing to his disciples, and we've heard two of them today. But there's no attempt to describe the actual moment of the resurrection. As a result, Christians have had to imagine that moment. And what is striking is that two profoundly different visions have evolved. The West celebrates the individual resurrection. Christ rises triumphantly and magnificently, but utterly alone. The guards of the tomb may be shown asleep or awake, but nobody else rises in, by, or with Christ. The Eastern Church, on the other hand, celebrated the universal resurrection. Here, Christ also rises triumphantly and magnificently, but he takes all of humanity with him." So it's probably very bad taste to begin an Easter sermon with a resurrection joke, but I have one. And it is April Fool's Day. And since there aren't many resurrection jokes, I'm sure you've heard some version of this one before. Here's my version. Three lonely guys are sitting at a bar on the Saturday of Easter weekend, and as the evening wears on and the drinks flow, they start to engage in conversation. And one of them, the guy on the left, asks, "So, what do you all think about the resurrection?" "Whose resurrection?" retorts the guy in the middle. "You mean Jesus or that guy that he got to come out of the tomb? What was his name, Lazarus?" No, "Jesus, of course," says the other guy. "I was raised a good Irish Catholic, and I was taught to believe that after Jesus was crucified, he rose from the dead on the third day, and he appeared to his disciples. What about you?" "Well," says the guy in the middle, "I was raised an evangelical Protestant, and I was taught that there would be a second coming when Jesus would return, and all believers would be raised from the dead at the time of the rapture." Well, the third guy at the bar has been listening to all of this and is a little mystified by the conversation. And he says, "No, wait a minute, don't you guys have it all wrong? I mean, my family never went to church, but I'm pretty sure that when Jesus comes out of his tomb every spring, he looks around, and if he sees his shadow, we get six more weeks of winter." Now, like most jokes, this one brings forth several truths about what has happened to the Christian story of Jesus' resurrection. You can take it as a story that is literally true about the human person of Jesus, just like the first guy does. And many traditional Christians believe that Jesus literally came back to life after dying, walked out of his tomb, just as he had commanded Lazarus to do in the story of the book of John, and then appeared with his wounded original body to his disciples and friends after he died. Many observant Christians who may not be so sure about the literal truth of the story believe nevertheless that resurrection is a theological truth, that the story is pointing to a spirit that does not die and that lives on after we die. And often, for these Christians, the belief in a spirit or soul that survives our death is part of an eternal life in heaven, into which belief in Jesus as your personal Savior gains you entry. So the evangelical Protestant version of that story has a general resurrection for believers at the end of time when Jesus returns. And then there are the liberal Christians, lots of them actually, or those who may not be so sure they should even call themselves Christians, but who wish to understand respectfully and sympathetically Christian stories and beliefs, because both the stories speak to them and because they are interested to know what they can learn from them. And I presume that I can count many among us today who would be within that number. This is the attitude towards the resurrection story that Unitarian Universalists as a whole have adopted within the context of our non-creedal faith. Most of us approach the resurrection story as a metaphor, a story that points to something real or promised about our lives, even if the story is not literally true or metaphysically true. So for us, what does this metaphor of resurrection point towards? What can we say is true about resurrection? Well, many of our congregations prefer to engage with the Easter story as a metaphor that ties most closely to what's happening with spring. And it's certainly one of the powerful and important and legitimate ways to see resurrection in real life as a truth that we experience every year at this time. Trees and plants that look dead come to life again and display their beauty. Hope is reborn with this reminder that the dark days of winter don't last forever. And I have created plenty of Easter services around those themes myself, and we hear them echoed in the beautiful anthem that the choir did so well today, and in the closing hymn, we're reminded of the resurrection of spring. But at a certain point in my own ministry, in not necessarily identifying personally as a Christian, I came to the conclusion that I didn't want to merely acknowledge or even kind of dismiss Christian Easter on Easter Sunday, or frame it as a myth that we argue against, or as a superstitious conclusion to an otherwise accessible story about a great spiritual teacher. There's something more there, and plenty of people arrive at the doors of a Unitarian Universalist congregation these days without having had very much formal religious background or maybe education. And what people sometimes have absorbed about the depth and the differences among the faiths of the world is mostly arrived at through media images or television, depending on where you've gone to school. Folks don't necessarily arrive quite as muddled as our friend at the end of the bar, for whom the cultural holidays that he sees evoked in the media finally all mush together. But Easter can get pretty mushy. It's a cultural holiday that gets this respectful nod in popular culture, but that lots of people experience mostly as an excuse to buy chocolate rabbits and go out for brunch. I decided some time ago that I owe it to my congregations and myself to use Easter Sunday to go deeper into what this central Christian claim might mean to people who are rational spiritual seekers. Can it be true, as St. Paul claimed in the first letter to the Corinthians, that if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain? That is so often what Christians are told. Well, I don't believe that for a minute. There are plenty of people who call themselves Christians and who appreciate the Christian tradition for whom resurrection has a real meaning, although not a literal meaning. It's a word that has its Latin roots in a word resurgo, which literally means to rise again, or to exhibit new vitality and strength. And using that original meaning and learning from my friends who are liberal Christians, I found three different ways that resurrection becomes real in my life and experience, and perhaps in yours. Resurrection is real in the memories of human beings throughout time. Resurrection is real in the ways that people embody Jesus' way of living. And resurrection is real in the ways that Jesus' teachings inspire human movements of liberation that free people in both body and spirit to live their full potential. So let's talk a little bit more about each of these ways that resurrection is real. I was watching TV the other night, and in sort of an unlikely place on a comedy show, I heard an excellent description of the ways that human memory is a way of bringing people back to life and making them real in the world again in a powerful way that relates to religious metaphors. There was a character in this comedy who was a former Catholic priest who had re-entered secular life, and he was counseling a friend who was worried about whether having come out as gay would mean that he would be going to hell forever. And the former priest listened to him and told him that what he knows for sure about the life that we live after we die is in the memories of those who knew us. And if we are remembered well, we are in heaven. And if we are not, we are in hell. And I rather like that. You know, that made some sense to me. I thought about this week ahead when we're remembering Martin Luther King Jr. as we pass through the 50th anniversary of the day of his assassination. And, you know, I put Dr. King's face up on the board of images that we had of Jesus because he's so often remembered and named with Jesus as a teacher of nonviolent commitment to justice and equality for all. Most of us here have been had the privilege in our own lives of being witnesses to the power and to the problems of memory as it creates an ongoing life of a revered spiritual leader after his original life is over. With Dr. King, there are probably people in this room, I'm one of them, who may have seen him in person, at least on television, and who certainly in your lives felt the impact of his living leadership. And then he was killed. And after his death, we experienced a period of mourning, of disarray and uncertainty about whether the movement that he led was going to be sustainable and would carry forward the changes that he advocated. And part of the effort to do that meant institutionalizing King's memory through initially a formal holiday. And that was an effort that took a decade of advocacy to bring about. And then another part of the effort to make the movement sustainable meant researching the history of King's life. And that involved, as his biographers dug deeper, a confrontation with the man's humanity, with his sins, with his failures, as well as his triumphs, along with understanding more deeply the way that this one person had made such an impact. And now, 50 years later, we have adults who have grown up hearing about Dr. King as one more assignment in a history class, or seeing him as a statue on the National Mall that is a cultural icon of the struggle for freedom and equality. I am convinced that the process of Jesus' resurrection happened in this same way. Initially in the memories of those who knew and loved him and those whose lives he had changed. Memory is all that they had back, all they had to hold back the stone from rolling across the mouth of that tomb and sealing it again forever. The surviving written records that we have of people teaching about Jesus in the book of Acts and in the letters of Paul and through the Synoptic Gospels date at the earliest more than 20 years after Jesus had died. 20 years. It's what it takes for people to start to feel some urgency about changing their personal memories into something more solid, into memorials, into communities, into institutions. And this is where we appreciate the second way that resurrection becomes real, which is when people are inspired to change their goals, their values, their beliefs, and their way of life to embody what they have learned from their teacher, their leader. So resurrection is real when people embody the mind and the heart and the teachings of Jesus. And there is a helpful idea from the Buddhism that I'm involved in that I think is useful here. In Buddhism, we often talk about Buddhas, plural, not only about a Buddha, who, as a single person who did live a life in north central India and who died 2,500 years ago. That Buddha is understood as one embodiment of a consciousness, of an understanding, as a way of life, and the goal of the practice is to become a Buddha, to embody that same consciousness. So many Christians who may not necessarily believe in the literal resurrection or reanimation of the body after death believe in a Jesus that lives again and again in the lives and in the bodies of those who have learned and practiced the truths that he taught. Now, people who believe in the second coming of Jesus at the end of time often have an imagination, as we said earlier, that is derived of what that will look like. Their imagination is derived from 16th century artists in Europe. But I think that story of Jesus' followers on the road to Emmaus is a better picture of what's really going on about Jesus' second coming. Jesus is resurrected and is walking beside us a lot throughout our lives, and we don't recognize him. Our picture of what he would look like is distorted by art and media and scripture. And there are people who live a Jesus life without much recognition at all beyond the circle of friends and acquaintances and those whose lives they have changed for the better. And insofar as Dr. King led a Jesus life that was recognized and that was real and that was inspirational, Jesus was alive again in him. So his picture deserved to be up there, even though not many of our kids voted for him. And I put a feminine image of Jesus on that board because it's important for us to get beyond the idea that Jesus' historical male body somehow limits or embodies what a Jesus life looks like. And I put myself on that board as a young man for a reason. I think Jesus saves insofar as we look at what his life meant and how we are inspired to live that kind of life ourselves. It's available to all of us. And that brings me to the third way that resurrection is real in our lives. If we only focus on individual lives and look for the meaning of human existence in only those few great spiritual exemplars of human history, we miss something very important about the billions of other lives that share this planet over history and collectively together now, and what those lives mean. In our common life as one humanity, the great insights about how to live our individual lives have come from focusing on the values we hold in common that advance the cause of all humanity. Not just the cause of one family, or one tribe, or one nation, or one species even. The great spiritual teachers and the social leaders that they inspired are not only alive through preservation of their words in books, or in holidays, or in monuments, but they are alive in movements, in communities that collectively innovate, agitate, and legislate to bring new vitality and strength to all people and help everyone achieve their full potential. And I see that now so strongly in this 50th anniversary year after Dr. King's life ended. I see it in the new Poor People's Campaign. The Poor People's Campaign that he and Ralph Abernathy were working on when he died has been resurrected in the contemporary Poor People's Campaign led by Reverend William Barber. And in the reading that I offered this morning from John Dominic and Sarah Crossan, they describe this Eastern Christian vision, this more orthodox Eastern Christian vision of the resurrection as communal and not individual. We all rise again through the life of Jesus, says this vision of Christianity. Echoing the most familiar teachings of Dr. King, the Crossans, who are among the most prolific and respected of the liberal Christian scholars that are teaching today, have this to say in their new book about the original Easter vision. They say, as we've traveled and studied the Bible and early human civilizations, it's become increasingly clear to us that the main problem from which humans need to be saved is escalatory or escalating violence. You know, the inaugural mention of sin in the Bible is not around the apple of knowledge that Eve takes, but it's about Cain's murder of his brother Abel. As civilization's drug of choice, intensifying, escalating violence deludes us into believing that peace on earth will result from some kind of global control that nonviolence will ultimately derive from consummating violence. Very deliberately, Crossan suggests, Jesus of Nazareth lived and died from incarnating one obvious answer, and surely it is the only possible answer. Programmatic, nonviolent resistance to violence alone can end civilization's trajectory of escalation. So in this liturgy that we do most weeks in this congregation, we've been including a response to violence. And the more that we have done this, month after month, I've become convinced that we're drawn instinctively to stating this as part of our faith in a church like this one when we gather for worship. Affirming nonviolent resistance to the violent normalcy of civilization is a bold and creative interpretation of the meaning of Jesus' life and death and of Jesus' resurrection. But we feel it. We feel it resonating through the life of Dr. King and others that we admire throughout history who stood for the best of what humanity represents. It's a statement of faith that is compelling to Unitarian Universalists of varying beliefs and attitudes. And our historic Universalist understanding of this life has been that no one rises alone, that we all must rise together. All are worthy, and all are ultimately saved. We live within the lives of others that have come before us, and we honor and embody and carry forward the best of those lives because, really, it's all just one life that we are living. And for me, that's the truth about resurrection. May it be so.